Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again to another edition of the Come Out of For My People show. I'm your host, Mark Call. This is a show where we talk about some of the elements surrounding that admonition from Revelation 18:4 that says, come out of her, my people, meaning the whore, whatever you think the whore is nowadays, from the whore church to the whore economy to, Babylon in general, or at least the greater Babylon metro area. In any case, come out of all of that, one way or another, so that you do not participate in her sins, and I've said for a long time, I think those are obvious, or, hopefully, partake of her plagues, which are increasingly and inevitably getting more obvious almost by the day. Now, as we think about that, and many of us at least have started to make some moves in that direction, I know that one of the hurdles, this is one of the things I get the most feedback about, one of the greatest difficulties that almost all of us face one way or another, and sometimes it may even start to seem like it's pervasive, has to do with family and friends and people that basically just don't get it. They simply do not see that there's a problem, or if there is a problem, it's so overwhelming that they can't possibly imagine that it, A, could happen here, or B, face up to the implications. Because it's almost too overwhelming even to admit is real. So in other words, one way to put it just might be that the biggest hurdle people face is recognizing that this nagging sensation that they've had, that things are completely insane, is more true, more imminent, and yeah, in that sense, more frightening than they were willing to believe could be possible. So, if there is a title for today's show, it's something along the lines of The Biggest Hurdle and How Do We Deal With It? So with that in mind, I'm going to do things a bit differently today and actually start out with at least one possible solution right up front, because ultimately, while it certainly sounds good and most of us would say, oh yeah, this is perfectly reasonable, if we look at the world and we ask ourselves what's going on, well, it's not reasonable. It's downright stinking insane. You'd have to be absolutely either a blithering idiot, a total moron, or something wrong with you in order not to see just how far gone most of the world is. The problem? Most people just plain won't see it. Now, a lot of them, they just turn a blind eye to it. They're oblivious. But in other cases, there's something more going on. So we're going to deal with both those issues. But I'm going to start off, like I suggested, with the obvious situation of saying, hey, here are some pieces of evidence. Here are some facts that you just plain can't ignore. And furthermore, if you see them, you can't possibly ignore the fact that they demonstrate something is horribly wrong, insanely wrong even. So what does that mean? And then maybe a dialogue can begin. What we're going to talk about after the bottom of the hour, of course, is why if they don't respond to that and the dialogue doesn't begin, well, we know there is more going on, and that, too, is vitally important to understand. So let me kick things off with that example that I alluded to, and let's call it stuff that I wouldn't blame you if you don't want to believe, but you had better. Because it's true, and certainly it's the kind of thing that, if people were paying attention, ought to at least show them how far down a trail that leads to, well, utter devastation, we've already gone. And these are literally just some current examples. There are many, many more, but once they start to see a few, hopefully the rest will begin to fall into place. And there are actually so many candidates with which we could start this segment off that it's almost tough to know where to begin. So maybe we should start small and work up. For example, when it comes to tyranny, it's not really that difficult to recognize Canada is so far ahead, they've almost crossed the finish line. Fidel Castro's little boy is right on top of the heap when it comes to terrorizing people in the name of his tyranny. The Trudeau regime, says a piece from Hal Turner's radio show, is now introduced, and this is a real, no, it's not a shocker at all, folks, Orwellian new law called the Online Harms Bill, C-63, which will give police the power to retroactively search the internet for hate speech violations and arrest offenders, even if the offense occurred before the law ever even existed. Now, in the United States, this is unconstitutional. What these things are called ex post facto laws. If you did it and it's not a crime, they can't come after you later. But in Canada, they can come after you anytime they blankety blank and well want to. Revolver News puts it this way. The real shocker in this bill is the alarming retroactive aspect. Essentially, whatever you said in the past can now be, and will be, no doubt, weaponized against you by today's increasingly draconian standards. Historian Dr. Muriel Blave weighed in on the Beyond Orwellian new law, labeling it outright mad, but that shouldn't surprise anybody, because that's exactly what's going on all over the place nowadays. She points out how it literally spits in the face of all Western legal traditions, yeah, and the concept that we once had of ex post facto laws being against the law. But the Canadian proposal goes beyond mere insanity. It's retroactive, it's Orwellian, it's totalitarian, it's an ex post facto law, and it allows them to go back and come after you all the way to the dawn of the internet. But I have no doubt that if they could come up with a way of proving that you said something before you were even born, they could charge you for that nowadays. As the story says, it's a gold embossed invitation to offense archaeologists to do their very worst. By the way, with the prospect of a $20,000 paycheck if they hit pay dirt. And isn't this special? Their identity is shielded, so you don't even know who done you in. It's a new variant of electronic swatting, but where the perps get paid. The only way to protect yourself is to go through your own socialist media accounts and painstakingly delete anything remotely controversial that you've ever said. Kind of like Orwell and the Ministry of Truth in the United States is doing. And guess what? You can't actually do that because the Wayback Machine, and there are other ways of preserving what was on the web at any point in time, that is, if they don't get completely expunged. So it's kind of a losing battle, unless, of course, you're a three-letter agency.
In which case, you can get away with killing or framing presidents.
If the courts, sick, believe that you might, perhaps think about preparing to commence to commit a thought crime, or a hate crime, or disseminate hate propaganda, or anything else that they eventually decide they might want to call a crime, not yet defined, you can be placed under house arrest and have your ability to communicate with others restricted. Why don't they just cut out people's tongues right when they're born and save themselves a problem? Oh, wait a minute, you got to cut off their fingers, too.
Because they might be able to type it. But as Orwell noted, no, it doesn't even end there. The very act of maybe thinking something, or even having them think that you might think something, ultimately is a crime.
And here's a crime. America's Gestapo is back at it, too. This one courtesy of Sean Fleetwood at The Federalist says, the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Instigation and Insurrection, obviously unchastened by getting caught, is restarting its own censorship effort ahead of the upcoming and rigged, and you know it because they're already well underway, 2024 election. On Monday this week, Senator Sick Mark Warner, scumbag from Virginia, chair of the Senate Intelligence Sick Committee, told reporters that federal agencies like the FBI und the Cybersecurity und Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, have restarted discussions with their public-private fascist partnerships at big tech. According to NextGov/FCW, this coordination will focus on, listen to this, removing disinformation on their sites as the November presidential election nears. Warner claimed these talks resumed in March before they told you about it, but you knew it was happening anyway, didn't you? About the same time as the oral arguments and lying justifications from Big Brother to boot were being heard by the Supreme Court. In Murthy v. Missouri, which centers on the Fed's censorship efforts that didn't come out until after they rigged the last election and thought they got away with it. When pressed on the validity or not of the remarks by the totalitarian senator, an FBI representative confirmed to the Federalist that the agency had in fact resumed communications with socialist media companies ahead of the upcoming election rig. And listen to this, quote, the FBI remains committed to combating foreign malign influence operations, what, except the CCP, of course, and the invaders that are coming across the non-existent southern border, including in connection with our elections. See, they're not your elections anymore, at least they're admitting that. That effort, they continue, includes sharing specific foreign threat information with state-owned local pretend election officials and private sector companies when appropriate and rigorously consistent with the law, unquote, and of course, as we define it, and we're above it. But the spokeslayer wasn't done yet. In coordination with the Department of Just Us, the FBI recently implemented procedures to facilitate sharing information about foreign malign influence with socialist media companies in a way that reinforces, what a crock of shit, folks, that private companies are free to decide on their own, yeah, if they know what is good for them, whether or not and how to take action on that information.
I'm going to make them an offer again with you.
Oh, and this is precious. When pressed for comment, neither FBI nor CISA responded about when or why they restarted what they laughably call communications with socialist media platforms on their mutually beneficial efforts to resume censorship.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
And you're sure as hell not going to get it from the FBI, folks. notes the piece, no, it's not just election interference by the FBI and other three-letter agencies on behalf of the deep state that is at issue here, although that certainly is one of several. Other massive censorship efforts include the two-part bioweapon and the Zyklon B injections that have killed already millions of Americans, and millions more are now walking dead, waiting to die from turbo cancers, myocarditis, pericarditis, strokes, or just plain destruction of their immune systems. Any information about what was being injected into their bloodstreams, of course, was called disinformation, misinformation, or just plain censored. And let's not forget, they suppressed information from the New York Post report about the Hunter Biden laptop from hell, as well as the Biden crime family business operations and the kickbacks for the big guy ahead of the 2020 rigged election as well. Says the piece, the issue of government-compelled censorship is, in fact, front and center in Murthy v. Missouri, a.k.a. Missouri v. Biden, too, that case before the SCOTUS, which focuses on allegations from both Missouri and Louisiana and other attorneys general, too, folks, if they had the cojones to do so, that Big Brother's pressuring of socialist media companies to censor otherwise free speech online constitutes, gee, do you think, a violation of the First Amendment. And U.S. District Court Judge Terry Doty issued a preliminary injunction in July of 2023, barring Big Brother's three-letter agencies from doing exactly what they're now doing again, colluding with Big Tech to censor posts they and the Biden Fuhrer's puppet masters don't like. In his ruling, Doty wrote, quote, if the allegations made by plaintiffs are true, this present case arguably involves the most massive attack against free speech in United States history, unquote. And yeah, folks, not only is it not over yet, they're kicking it into higher gear ahead of the election rig that you know is already well underway. And oh yeah, while we're on the subject, one more quick related piece from the You Won't Believe It, But You Must files and the election rig. CNN legal analyst. Huh? Yeah, a CNN legal analyst has even seen through the BS here when it comes to the Stormy Daniels circus. And oh yeah, folks, how bad is it? They'd rather even talk about this than the Jack Smith humiliation. Her responses, he admitted, were disastrous. CNN hooker for hire and so-called legal analyst Eli Honig said that although Daniels' testifying about a sexual encounter with Trump in a hotel room in 2006 was at least plausible, her responses, while under oath and cross-examination by Trump's legal team, called her whorish credibility into question. And referring to the fact that she came right out and admitted that she hated President Trump, Honig said her responses were disastrous. And he added, that's a big deal. When a witness hates the person whose very liberty is at stake, that's a damn big deal. And he said she's putting out tweets, fantasizing about him being in jail. That really undermines her credibility. And he even referenced Daniel's comment that she has no intention of paying the court-ordered legal fees that Trump won when her defamation case failed and was tossed out. She said on social media she'll go to jail before she pays him a penny. Said the CNN analyst, the fact that she owes him $500,000 by court order, owes Donald Trump $500,000 and said, I'll never pay him, I will defy the court order. Well, the defense, he noted, is going to say she's willing to defy a court order. She's not willing to respect an order from a judge. Why does anybody think she's going to respect this oath that she took? So said CNN's legal analyst, quote, I thought it went quite poorly on cross-exam. And I gotta ask it again. This obvious testifying had nothing whatsoever to do with a literally trumped up sham case, much ado about nothing that they all know wasn't even a crime. It was in fact a misdemeanor, if anything, and the statute of limitations expired years before they decided to dredge this thing up and try to use it to impugn the character of the guy who's gonna rub the diapered face of the fake president in his own lies if there was to be an election. And they're not gonna allow that. So they're looking for something, anything, to distract from the disastrous headlines that show just how corrupt, utterly lawless, and yes, downright traitorous they really are. Which brings me next to one that I really did have to work up to. Because this next story is one that I actually heard several times this week, folks. And honestly, it was so beyond idiotic that I had trouble even believing it until I saw the video and confirmed, yeah, this actually looks real. And this moron, Jared Bernstein, is supposedly the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. And while he doesn't seem to be absolutely senile like the fake president is, he does kind of lend a new depth of understanding to the word clueless. He's certainly a fake economic advisor to anybody above first grade level. Listen to this and try to imagine that somebody actually decided this person is enough of an expert on economics and the creation of so-called money. Well, what? I can't even finish the sentence. At least John Maynard Keynes knew how to baffle him with bullshit.
The U.S. government can't go bankrupt because we can print our own money.
Like you said, they print the dollar. So why does the government even borrow?
Well, some of this stuff gets, some of the language and concepts are just confusing. I mean, the government.
Well, they're definitely confusing to him. Hey, maybe that's why they call it magical money theory.
Some of the language and concepts are just confusing. I mean, the government definitely prints money, and it definitely lends that money, which is why the government definitely prints money, and then it lends that money by selling bonds. Is that what they do?
I don't know. Do they really? Are you sure?
Is that what they do? They sell bonds. Yeah, they sell bonds. Right, since they sell bonds and people buy the bonds and lend them the money. Yeah, so.
Well, now, in fairness here, I can understand his confusion because nobody really wants to buy these bonds anymore. So that's why the Fed has to buy them themselves because they can't find anybody else willing to do it. I mean, really, would you buy a bond from this moron?
Yeah, they sell bonds, right? Since they sell bonds and people buy the bonds and lend them the money. Yeah, so a lot of times, at least to my ear with MMT, the language and the concepts can be kind of unnecessarily confusing, but there is no question that the government prints money, and then it uses that money to I don't know what they're talking about, like, because it's like the government clearly prints money. It does it all the time, and it clearly borrows, otherwise we wouldn't be having this debt and deficit conversation. So I don't think there's anything confusing there.
Well, unless you're not a moron, in which case you understand that printing money out of nothing is the very definition of a dishonest weight and measure. No wonder the entire world economy and anything based on the biggest fiat debt bubble in history is such a stinking mess and poised on the edge of utter breakdown. I wish the interviewer would have asked him the really tough question. Hey, if we can print our own money, why do we even need an IRS to steal money from people who don't have it to begin with? Ha ha, they can't print it, can they? But ironically, they can go bankrupt.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Bottom line, folks, there's a whole lot of stuff happening that you really don't want to believe. But you'd sure as you know what better. Which brings me to the second aspect of what I want to talk about today. And the point of that whole introduction was that there are a whole lot of things that, at least in terms of being able to address the facts with people, we ought to be able to have a command of and to go through. Whether it's the breakdown of the entire system of what was once called justice or the court system, the idea of probable cause and being able to face your accuser, all kinds of things that were once the backbone of the common law system. Things that are now dead and buried and done away with because, hey, some people are just above the law. You know who they are, and you know that they don't necessarily know even what the law is anymore, or they don't care. So one of the things that I want to propose is we can use these indicators as kind of a test. In other words, are people paying attention? If they are, they're going to start to be asking themselves questions like, gee, what's it going to take before I recognize that cutting of genitalia off little boys and girls, that is not exactly what you call a normal thing. Teaching people all kinds of, well, perversions in the public cesspool. So that's not exactly a normal thing either. You know, I could go through an entire show and probably have with just examples of that. But one of the things that I think people notice is, wait a minute, they don't seem to be paying attention to that. In other words, a lot of folks are just plain oblivious to it. It's almost like they're, it's almost like they're delusional. I use the term frequently, insane, or maybe stupid. Sometimes stupid is a good word because it describes what it looks like when they can't connect facts and don't understand what's going on. Turns out that there are some terms that you'll hear, and I'm going to go through some of these and some other things today. One is cognitive dissonance. And this is the idea of having something which is just kind of so foreign to your way of thinking that you can't put your head around it. And maybe it wakes people up, shocks them into realizing something. a significant emotional event, or maybe they just turn off their brain. And Orwell called it doublethink, right? Holding two utterly contradictory things in your mind at the same time and not having the cognitive ability to be able to see, hey, these things can't possibly both be true. We got a whole lot of people that literally have made a career out of teaching and pushing that kind of thing down people's throats. Now, that is kind of where I'm going to head in the second segment. But what I want to do is get there with a couple of other indicators that certainly most people that have a scriptural background, a biblical worldview will understand. And literally, in this case, it's the Apostle Paul in a letter to the Thessalonians talking about exactly what the prophet Isaiah wrote as well. And they are similar, just slightly different phrasings of the very same thing. Let's start with Isaiah, because he had it first. And he says this, talking about idolatry and those upon whom Yah will look. And in verse 2 of chapter 66, he says, hey, this is the one on whom I will look, on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word. In other words, people that read his word and understand and recognize, wow, there's some kind of scary stuff in there if we're not walking in obedience. Maybe we ought to have awe at his understanding and therefore be willing to walk in that obedience. But the next verse says this after the introduction that has to do with idolatry. And then it says, just as they, these idolaters, all these people that I will suggest we can see literally pulling the strings, running the shots, rigging the slot machines and the tables in the crooked casino. Well, it says, just as they've chosen their own ways and their soul delights in their abominations, so, says the Creator, will I choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them. Because when I called, no one answered. When I spoke, they did not hear, but instead they did evil before my eyes. Okay, I've quoted that one fairly frequently because I think it's absolutely a description of what's going on today. And this idea of choosing their delusions has fascinated me for quite a while. Because when you look at the kind of things that people, well, want to believe today, the cognitive dissonance, the doublethink, and the fact that they can't see it, can't connect the dots, you got to say, what's wrong with them? Answer. If the Creator himself has blinded them and chosen their delusions, who are we to think we're going to be able to talk them out of it or show them some fact that's going to make a difference? And that's part of the point. Now, the other one from Paul says this, the mystery of lawlessness, Torahlessness is a good way to put that, is already at work. He who restrains now will only do so until he is taken out of the way. In other words, till the time has come. Are we there yet? And then the lawlessness of the one who's coming will be revealed, and Yahuwah will consume him with the breath of his mouth and destroy him with the brightness of his coming. This is according to the working of Hasatan, the adversary. You've heard this, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, with all unrighteous deception among those who are fixing to perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. Now, for this reason, it says, and here's the key, Elohim will send them strong delusion. That's kind of exactly what Isaiah is talking about, right? Strong delusion, so that they should believe the lie. And here's what's worse, that they might all be condemned who did not believe the truth, but instead had pleasure in Torah disobedience, in unrighteousness. Exactly the kind of thing that Isaiah said too. They did evil before my eyes. They chose that in which I do not delight. So a lot of indications there that while it's important, I think, to understand some of these tests and be able to give an account and to speak to people and see whether or not they can connect the dots and see some of the obvious things and recognize the lawlessness that is now abounding that we were also warned about in Matthew chapter 24, there comes a point at which we have to say, if the Creator has chosen their delusion, if they have this kind of pleasure in unrighteousness, and he has in fact sent them, as Paul says, strong delusion that they should believe the lie. Well, guess what? We're not going to be able to talk them out of it. So then what? Well, when we get back, I want to talk about a really interesting set of things that I saw in an excellent book, and I'll give you the title of the book. It's called The Indoctrinated Brain by a fellow named Dr. Michael Nels, and I want to go through some of his concepts because he has a really fascinating hypothesis, and a part of the hypothesis is that you know where we are? We're at a place where we're going to see so much of this, and it's already coming to pass. Which takes us now to the bottom of the hour break, and what we're going to talk about when we get back is the other side of the coin. We're going to have some discernment so that we can begin to use the tests that I've tried to outline in this first part to discern or tell the difference between those where there is some chance of getting them to have eyes to see and to wake up and do what needs to be done, and where, to put it bluntly, there's just not. And we'll be right back.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Cold or thrown.
Welcome back to the second segment of the show for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and this one is entitled The Biggest Hurdle. And I started out by suggesting the biggest hurdle has to do with convincing people who have chosen to be blind, who are willfully ignorant, who have eyes but do not see, who are engaged in what George Orwell called doublethink and so forth. Just maybe you can hit them with some facts. Maybe you can show some of the cognitive dissonance. Maybe you can shock them out of it, or maybe not. And that was the point, because I mentioned the quotations from Scripture, and I'm going to come up with some other ones here in a second, like Isaiah that says, because they have chosen their own ways and their soul delights in those abominations. Hey, why do you think they wave that rainbow flag and have such pride in those abominations? Well, he says, so will I choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them. We can see that. It's literally happening right before our eyes. The strong delusion that they believe the lie is here. Well, so is there a bit more? And this is the place I want to focus the rest of the show, and of course some of the things that we can do about it as well. That's key. A lot of it obviously has to do with knowing who we serve and understanding some things in Scripture, but I think it's kind of fascinating that there are some other pieces to this puzzle too. And I mentioned as we went to break a story and a book that I have sitting here. And I've heard the fellow interviewed. I'd like to see if I can't get him on. I haven't been able to do that yet, but perhaps we will. Anyway, this is by Dr. Michael Nels, and it's called The Indoctrinated Brain. And it has to do with literally the global attack on, as he puts it, your mental freedom. And I want to begin as he does, because there's a little bit of introduction. I'll try to make it as quick as I can, but I do think it's important. Some of the terminology that he uses may be a bit foreign to folks. Certainly we know what short-term memory is. And how short-term memory works, we know that one of the things that happens with Alzheimer's, you can see it with the Biden-Fuhrer and others, is a failure of short-term memory and the ability to not recognize where they are, walking into walls and so forth. The short-term memory is located, says most of medicine, in the frontal lobe of the brain, directly behind what they call the thinking brow. But it consists basically of brain waves or electrical impulses between nerve cells and doesn't actually record anything. So thus, it says, no long-term memories are created. And ultimately, what has to happen is somehow they have to be transferred from short-term memory to long-term memory. Now, here's where the real key comes in. There is a thing, and there's actually, it's located in two temporal lobes of the brain, so it's plural. But you've heard it called the hippocampus, because there are more than one of these. Rightfully, they are hippocampi, he says. And we'll talk about the hippocampus as if they were all together. And along with the olfactory brain, which has to do with remembering smells, all of this is part of what the old Greek terminology derives as the archicortex, which is the oldest region of our cerebral cortex. And although these two hippocampi together only make up about 1% of our brain by volume, without them we wouldn't have the ability to remember a thought or an episode in our lives for more than just a few seconds. And it has to be transferred to permanent memory. And he talks about how emotional selection plays a part in this, and all the things that are involved in making this happen. What's kind of fascinating, you may have heard this, is during deep sleep, our brain transfers the emotionally significant thoughts and personal experiences collected during the day in our limited memory stick, the hippocampus, to what's called the neocortex, which has a much larger data storage capacity. It's kind of like the neocortical hard drive. And basically, this is where the long-term memories, and as he notes, a lot of the things that have to do with our individual personality and our individuality are stored there. And there is a part of the sleep you've heard of called REM, or rapid eye movement. Bottom line, we need to sleep and to dream. And this is why sleep is important. One of the things that happens when people don't think is they become sleep deprived, and that causes part of the problem. We have to be able to sleep and dream in order to remember what we've experienced and thought in the long term. All right, well, this is interesting so far. Where does that lead? Well, there's one other concept that I think was kind of fascinating. I actually hadn't heard much about this till I read the book. It has to do with what's called system one thinking, or maybe not thinking, and system two thinking. So, and there was some Nobel Prize winners that are involved in some of the development of this concept. But it's important to understand, says Dr. Nels, that our brain uses two different systems to maneuver us through life. They're called System 1 and System 2. System 1, and this is kind of the zombie process, if you want to think about it that way, this corresponds to the implementation of learned repetitive behaviors, things we do every day without having to think much about them. This includes the entire repertoire of stereotypical thought and behavior patterns that don't require much concentration, virtually no mental energy, because no real thinking is involved. And this high energy efficiency allows our executive center, in other words, our real thought processes, to operate in system one mode by default, which is beneficial because it does not require much mental energy, and it might save your life. For example, if you're standing in front of a bus, you don't have to cogitate about whether the driver will see you and stop in time. You just jump and worry about it later. It's better to act without thinking than taking the time to engage the system two thought processes, which turn out to be considerably slower, but does allow people to think things through. Well, you can kind of see it, I guess, already where this is headed. There's a lot of people that don't seem to be able to do much system two thinking, and that leads to what I think is the really fascinating part of the story here. And this is the one that I wanted to spend the most time on, and we don't have a lot of time in an hour show, but we'll do some of this later, but for now, what he describes, and I think it was a fascinating concept, it's, by the way, completely consistent with what I've talked about, what many, many medical doctors that haven't been whores for the system have talked about, everything from the war on ivermectin and the fact that they were trying to kill a lot of people, destroy their fertility and so forth, but it turns out they were also destroying brain function. So, here's how he puts it. I'll just summarize about four chapters worth of information. Many different COVID-19 measures had and have neuropathological effects. A common effect of what was done to people, whether they knew it or not, was depersonalization through the destruction of what this hippocampal function enables, which he calls autobiographical memory. In other words, we store these long-term things. They literally make us who we are. They're involved with our personality and our ability to think, the deeper system two kind of thoughts. This is a necessary precursor, he said, in other words, destroying this function, to successful indoctrination. We have to suspect that this is precisely what the intent was, the real purpose of those COVID measures. Therefore, it's most likely that it was a targeted attack. And when you realize that, many of the inconsistencies start to become clear. Connections open up to a new perspective, such as what is the most plausible explanation for choosing, and that was what was done. We know now that, and I'll come to that in a minute, it didn't happen by accident when they chose the coronavirus, the spike protein. What would be the most logical choice and why the corona family for the 2019 pandemic and the simulation? What are the odds that such a coronavirus would affect the part of your identity, the brain, that forms your very identity? Specifically, so many of the measures that were taken too, supposedly to contain the disease, not the least of which was the Zyklon B injection, what he calls spiking in the book. In other words, after a lot of discussion about various proteins and Wuhan and SARS-CoV-1 proteins and messengers and inflammatory elements and so forth, the bottom line is this. The coronary spike protein indirectly attacks the natural function of our autobiographical memory via, you could probably have guessed this, our own immune system. So knowing that the spike protein can cause lasting damage to the hippocampus, all that was needed, if the intent was to do exactly that, was to find an efficient way to deliver this neurotoxic viral protein to the brain, as if you had a vaccine. Now, not every drug, though, can easily cross the blood-brain barrier, and the brain uses that barrier to protect itself from potentially toxic foreign things, including viral material or chemotherapeutic agents and so forth. But years ago, there was something developed, you've heard of it, called LNPs, or lipid nanoparticles. They could act as a packaging to penetrate the brain. That is, they could cross the blood-brain barrier. And there's a lot of discussion about how they were developed and how they were used. Guess what? You can guess that Fauci and some of the other perps here knew about all of that and had a plan. Thus, the packaging of the modified viral spike mRNA into LNPs is a serious indication that it was accepted or even intended to deliver the viral spike RNA directly into the brains of those that were intended to be destroyed so that they could do so, and the spike would even be produced in brain cells, perhaps over a longer period. And he goes on to describe studies that noted the mRNA has been found in the brain despite having been injected into the muscle and so forth. And the problem is, last but not least, the inflammatory response triggered by the spike protein is neurotoxic and blocks neurogenesis, which is part of the idea of how you take neural cells and create new specific kinds of neural cells to make these short-term memories into long-term memories. You block all of that and you literally shut people down. And it looks like all of this was planned in advance. He talks about five steps in the preparation of a crime against humanity. One of them was kind of interesting, and if you haven't heard this, it's an interesting factoid. I have certainly been convinced for years at this point that lab leak was BS. It was intended, and it was developed, gain of function, to do exactly what it did, and it was released on purpose. And it was released as part of a highly coordinated, very intelligent, very well-planned attack. All right, so here you go. This is some researchers that talked about the furin cleavage sites and the spike proteins and says this. Conventional biostatistical analysis indicates that the probability of the sequence that they discovered when they looked at this bioweapon, the sequence being randomly present in a 30,000 nucleotide viral genome is 3.21 times 10 to the minus 11th power. In other words, not a chance in hell, folks, that this happened by natural means. That's probably putting it about as clearly as it can be put. That's 1/3,000,000,000,000. Okay, anyway, the small but highly toxic protein can easily cross the blood-brain barrier without the presence of LNPs, but you put those in there and the result can be neurotoxic to the brain, even if that virus only infects the respiratory tract. There's more detail about all the specifics here, all the investments and how it was done, a catastrophic chain reaction. Let's cut to the chase here and talk about what the actual plan is and how so much of this is so important to understand. And what I want to talk about are a couple elements. One, of course, what we can do to prevent the damage that is being done. One is obvious, avoid people that are carrying the spike protein and people that are producing these things in their bodies as best we can. If they're loved ones, well, then maybe you want to try to take a special look at some things that can be done to, I don't know that they can be cured, honestly, but at least to minimize the further damage. I guess that's the best way to put it. Anyway, COVID-19 measures as a means to the end of hippocampal destruction. And this is a multi-stage process, says the author. There are things that could be done to protect the health of the population. They weren't done. Vitamin D is a real key element, vitamin D3 and so forth. And I love this quote. This kind of helps put things together. Power, he says, at its most basic level, is defined by the degree of subjugation of those over whom one claims that power. So it's about power over their brains. This is the message of Aldous Huxley, some of the mechanisms that he talked about. Certainly it's a message of Orwell and different mechanisms that he talked about. All of these mechanisms, folks, and that's part of the point of the book here, were employed during the COVID-19 Zyklon B bioweapons attack on the whole stinking world. But he quotes Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you may have heard of him, a theologian and resistance fighter against the Third Reich, and he says this, the person that's being manipulated literally becomes stupid. Now, when you put that in conjunction with all the things I've been talking about, I will choose their delusion, says the Creator, the great delusion. And I have noticed that I've tended to use the word stupid more and more of late, because you look at this and you go, that's really the only way to describe what's happening. Now, says the author, that's not necessarily because he or she, the person that's being manipulated and being destroyed, lacks intellect. This particular kind of stupidity is more serious and a more serious enemy of the good than the evil. Here's Bonhoeffer. While one can protest against evil and expose it and prevent it by the use of force, we are defenseless against stupidity. Neither protest nor violence have any effect here. Arguments fall on deaf ears. Well, that's how I started the show. Have you noticed that? Does that seem to be exactly what's going on in the world today? Neither protest nor violence, although they will employ them, have any real effect. Arguments fall on deaf ears. Facts that contradict a stupid person's prejudice need not be believed. And if they're irrefutable, they're simply brushed aside as unimportant or incidental. Doesn't that pretty much describe exactly what most of us have witnessed and what we're seeing? An effective means to produce exactly this kind of stupidity, says Dr. Nels, which doesn't even exclude highly educated people, especially if they've been indoctrinated and they're already vulnerable to it, is to switch off neurogenesis in the hippocampus. In other words, shut down the function of this hippocampus. And that is precisely what most of the book is about, exactly how it's being done, and exactly some of the ways that it's being done, and they are literally legion. They include multi-layered fear propaganda, the spiking, the Zyklon B injection, and the many COVID measures that have contributed greatly to this, and then he goes through some detail about them. And there are a number of them. And by the way, what does destruction of the hippocampus look like? Answer, neurodegenerative diseases, senility, Alzheimer's. People aren't creating new index neurons. Their brain function is being destroyed. They don't store the short-term memories into long-term memories. And all of this stuff is exactly what happens. By the way, 5G is another element of this. And he talks about the frequency ranges. By the way, this is a nice technical discussion. As an engineer, this has always been of interest to me. Isn't it fascinating that 4G, for example, at much longer wavelengths, lower frequencies, is not? While it's damaging and will cause problems, don't put this damn thing next to your head. It will heat your brains, and it will cause degenerative effects there, too. But 5G is more pervasive because these transmitters are going to be everywhere. They're going to literally beam them down from Starlink onto people, and ultimately, these wavelengths are even more damaging. And there's a lot of information on that. You're not going to hear most of it from the waste stream media. A couple more items here to set the final stage. Remember the face mask idiocy? That was probably the thing that, even before the Zyklon B, really set me off, because I thought, you know, who are we kidding? These viral particles, if they're a virus, they're very, very small. This is like thinking that a cyclone fence, you know, a wire fence will protect you from mosquitoes. What stupidity. All it will do is cause your brain to suffer from a lack of oxygen and from an increase in carbon dioxide in your bloodstream, and that even makes you more vulnerable to diseases than you were before. And furthermore, the mandatory face masking made people feel isolated among other people. It certainly did more harm than good, psychologically as well as physically. Quote, this is a report from chemist and safety specialist Dr. Helmut Treindl. Wearing a mask leads to a disruption of verbal and nonverbal communication, limited facial recognition, makes it harder to recognize emotions, i.e. it breaks down society and communications. It also acts as an acoustic filter, causing speech intelligibility to be impaired, and that causes more problems. It's a multiplicative effect, and furthermore, as I've pointed out, you can walk into a mall and see how many people are drinking your damn Bud Light. It's just basically all around evil. Other adverse effects are related to brain toxicity from inhalations of various identified adhesives, organic solvents, VOCs or volatile organic hydrocarbons, formaldehyde silicates, oxides, metal, titanium, nanoparticles, and all kinds of stuff that's in various kinds of masks and cloth and other materials that are put in people's faces. Pregnant women even have a problem. And he mentions Aldous Huxley here, because one of the things that Huxley described in his book, A Brave New World, was bottled fetuses grown in the world of the novel whose brains are said to develop at a reduced capacity because of oxygen deprivation. Exactly, in other words, what they did to a whole generation of dumbed-down cesspool raised kids. And even turns out that young people are notably more vulnerable to stress, anxiety, and depression during the pandemic. And, you know, up and down the line, folks, it is incredible, but not surprising that this is exactly the kind of thing that was done deliberately and that we're seeing it. So when you put all that together, there's a whole lot more in the book. I want to encourage people, if you haven't seen this, take a look at it, because what is perhaps most important and the thing that I think is probably good to focus on are some of the things that he says are, well, counterindicators, things we can do, what he calls an anti-indoctrination formula in the book. And without going into all the detail that is in here, it boils down to this. Purpose in life is probably the most important thing to fight the indoctrination, the dumbing down, the destruction of the ability to do system two kind of thinking. And, well, think about it. Everything we talk about generally, come out of her, avoid some of the stupidity, the hopelessness, all of the satanic elements that literally are a choice of death over life. All of those things are about understanding scripture. They're about choosing. Choose this day whom you will serve. They're about the things that we should be up to, doing our Father's work and praying that we be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming and that we are found doing His work through all that lies ahead. So part one, if you will, the biggest idea of the anti-indoctrination formula is this purpose in life. But then there are some elements that kind of all buttress and support and work with one another on that. And they include some obvious things, and these are things you've almost certainly heard about. For example, your body needs exercise to function. That's good for you. That makes perfect sense. It needs nutrition. He notes that there's a thing called the law of the minimum that applies, and basically there are all kinds of deficiencies, iodine deficiencies, thyroid hormone deficiencies, all of which lead to loss of system 2 thinking capacity and destroy adult hippocampal neurogenesis. In other words, they can lead to Alzheimer's and other kinds of symptoms as well. We need various micronutrients. And there are all kinds of others. You probably are aware of them. Omega-3 acids and so forth. Vitamin D3 is very key. That vitamin D3, as it turns out, was also vital, and that's why they didn't talk about it. It would have been the single most important thing that could have been done widely. Get people out in the sun. Oh, guess what? That's why you're not allowed to exercise or go to the beach. Anything you begin to understand about the proper health benefits that should have been done and what was done instead just simply buttresses the case that it was a deliberate, not just dumbing down, but mass destruction of people's ability to think. And that explains so much. All right. As for the anti-indoctrination formula, social life was another one. The fact that we need human interaction. Oh, yeah. Guess what? The lockdowns did. And it has a detrimental effect when we don't get that. And there are other elements, too, like sleep. And I've already mentioned this. Part of being able to write the autobiographical memory and collect new experiences is about getting proper sleep. Frequent sleep interruptions, prolonged sleep deprivation have detrimental consequences for health, especially when it comes to cognitive performance. So all of these things, none of them should surprise us, but I think they're all fascinating, at least to be aware of. Now, I want to kind of begin to close as I started today. By simply saying, look, once we realize that this was not just an attack on people's ability to reproduce, that was clear. They wanted to destroy the ability of anybody. It destroyed male testosterone. It destroyed the female ovaries. And we're going to see a huge decline in fertility rates. That was all intentional. There were people that just plain died outright. Their immune systems were being destroyed. All of that I've talked about and we've known. But what was fascinating to me was the fact that, nope, this was an entirely multi-layered attack. And one of the things, perhaps even the most deadly and damaging thing long-term, was they destroyed people's ability to think. Especially what was called system two thinking, to creatively engage in dealing with an attack and come up with creative responses to it. So, well, as I always do, we'll close with a reminder. Part of it consists of come out of her, my people. But one of the things that I think is important, and we need to understand, choose this day whom you will serve, it's about being able to think creatively and recognizing that He has given us this ability. It's a God-given blessing. But we have to provide the things, including the social and the emotional and the intellectual stimulation of reading his word and understanding it and sharing it, and what's called midrash in the Hebrew, letting iron sharpen iron. In other words, the social elements, all of that is vital and important. But ultimately, one of the things that I think is so key that we cannot forget here is this idea that a large number of people have literally have their delusions chosen for them. They delight in their abominations, and honestly, we're probably not going to be able to save them. There comes a point, as Yeshua said, at which we simply have to say, okay, wipe the dust off our feet as a witness against them, and understand that we need to move on. So with that in mind, let me close with just a couple of other reminders that there are things we can do. One is discernment. We have to be able to separate ourselves and recognize that some people are going to pass some of these tests we've talked about in this hour, and they are going to be able to think creatively and adopt and adapt to the situation, and others are not. Guess which kind of people, as things get worse, we need to associate with? By the way, the scriptures tell us this too, right? Bad company corrupts good morals. And if they don't think, and if he's chosen their delusions for them, maybe the thing is just to move on and find other people with which to associate and to deal with when we have to face the challenges that certainly lie ahead. So with that, I'll say thanks for being with us, and let's make every effort to continue to use the brains that the Creator gave us. Shabbat shalom, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.